Accession number 19671, Real 4.
Harry McLean, Real 4.
Yeah, so, I rolled, it was excruciating pain, I'll never forget that. I rolled down this little bit of a bank onto this flat ground, hauled myself up and stood up, went to walk towards this tree and realised why the ground was so flat. It was a marsh. So of course I had to get back again, which I did do. So I wandered along the edge of this wood and didn't know quite what to do. So I knew I had to get help, but I wasn't going to give myself up, but I knew resistance was out of it, pointless. So I was walking along a bit of a hardened track and I came to a pair of gate posts with no gate, which I thought was leading into a field. So I thought, if I walk to one side of the field, I can walk up so far and sit in the hedge. That would be all right through the day. But of course, what I'd done, I'd walked into the end of a farmyard. So I walked a few feet in through the gates when dogs started to bark, two of them, smaller dogs, and they were in a barn or something. So I stopped to, well, get my bearings, I suppose, when a door opened on my left and I could see silhouette of the light, figure of a man. He said something to me, which quite obviously was anybody there. So I said, "It's been English a flieger." And he came out towards me and jabbered away. Well, I couldn't make, I mean, I only spoke pidgin, German, self-taught, really. So I pointed to the house. I said, "House, house." And he took me in. And there was a younger lady there, and I sat on a settee, and I gave him my dog tags, and he went off, obviously, to get help, and this lady rubbed my back for me, very Christian attitude. So I had a bit of a chat to her. She has recorded to a German source that I spoke perfect German, but I think there's a bit of romance there, because I knew enough to get by on, sort of thing. And there was a crucifix on the wall. I said, "What's that?" She said, "A crucifix." Well, I knew it was a crucifix, but what I meant to say was, "What's a crucifix doing here?" We expected to see swastikas and all that, you see. So I said, "Where am I?" She said, "Deutschland." I thought, "Deutschland? Can't be Dutch land." Anyway, you get these strange thoughts. Anyway, I had an escape pack in my trouser pocket, so I took that out and stuck it under the settee and told her it was for her. And the father came back then, the man. It subsequently, I thought at the time it was a father with a very young wife, you know, but it's father and daughter. And he came back with the local policeman, so they were chatting away, and on my dog tags, which I'd given to the farmer who'd given it to the policeman, there was a Lincoln Imp, and they were looking at this, and I heard the policeman say talisman, so I said, yeah, so he looked at me and said, "I wanted to know what's in." So more conversation went on, and I heard the policeman say, "Spazieren." Now, spazieren is a German word meaning to walk, and I knew this word, and I thought, how wonderful German it sounds, you know. Anyway, like a bloody idiot, I said, nein. So, of course, he looked at me again, obviously thinking I understood all their conversation, but I didn't know another word. Anyway, so eventually the policeman went off, and two soldiers turned up then with a stretcher. So they put me on the stretcher and took it out to a van, an ambulance. Now, this stretcher was so old that the canvas was so stretched, I was actually laying on the floor, but there was a rack for another stretcher by me, so I could pull myself up on that. So we went up the road about half a mile, I suppose, when the back door opened and got the engineer. Found out afterwards that he'd landed in the front half of the plane, very dazed, of course, and they picked him up sort of 100 yards from the plane. He'd been apparently walking around it, you know. So, of course, that was very cheering. So they took us to a police station, which I found out since was in a village on the edge of the Starnberg Lake called Tutzing. Put us in the cells for the night. Now, I can't say I slept. I might have dozed or whatever, but I was brought to in the morning. Some kids appeared at the window saying, "Good morning, Mr. Englishman. How are you?" So I got up, and there were three kids there with the packs on the back going to school. The biggest one introduced himself, I suppose he'd be about eight, as Richard. Dick, you say. He said, "There was an apple tree at the back." I said, "What are they?" He said, "Apples." I said, "Can I have one?" They gave me an apple. And that was my introduction to Germany. And I could have cried. I thought, good God. I said, we're bombing these people and they're teaching their kids English. You know, it really did affect me, that. But, so they took us off. Some army officers came for us and took us round the next day to the site where Jack had to identify the bodies there. And on the way round, we passed a signpost that said Dachau. Well, I knew there was something odd about Dachau even then. And then we landed up at a German aerodrome where an orderly who told me he was Austrian. And funny enough, at that time, all these Germans used to take great delight in telling you they were Austrian. Oh, God knows why. He said, "Did I want to go to hospital?" I thought, well, I don't fancy going in a hospital with the bomb victims. So I said, "I'll wait till I got to a prison camp." So they stuck a big piece of sticking plaster on me, rather like a waistcoat, gave me some anti-neuralgia pills, as they were called, and put me to bed. In the guard room where we were, the two pigeons from this plane had survived, and so they were in the guard room in their case, and also the dinghy radio. The dinghy radio was a yellow box. You pulled the air up and turned a handle and it sent out an automatic SOS, which they homed in on, you see. That was it. And also the G-box, the G's for early navigation system. Still a bit secret at that time. So in the morning, I don't recall ever having any breakfast. You know, they took us off again, and we went to the station where we got on a train. It was one of these small commuter things, you know, it's just a small thing. And there was the civvies there, and the lady sitting in the opposite side of the corridor to me leaned over and said in a quite heavy American accent, "Are you English?" I said, "Yes," and we had a bit of a chat, and the guards were quite happy about this. And she said to me, "And who's going to win the war?" So diplomatically, I said, "Mr. Churchill said we will." She said, "Oh, well, the Führer says that we will win." Well, of course, at this time, by about 2 days, the Italians had chucked it, but of course that was kept secret. I'd love to have been able to say to them, "Well, look, your Italian allies have already chucked it." You would imagine the stir that would have caused in this railway truck. Anyway, we went up to Dulag Luft, where the interrogation went on. I was there for about 3 days, I suppose. The chap who interrogated me was quite a nice fellow, had an easy time. Told me he worked for Whitbread's Brewery before the war in London. And they could get quite harsh with you, but he must have took pity on me. So then...
But in Munich, you were shown the damage.
Ah, no, wait a minute. No, not that stage. So then it came to leave. Now, we should go to an Air Force camp. But it was explained to us that because of the intensity of the bombing through the summer, the Battle of the Ruhr and the Battle of Hamburg, etc., that they'd been taking more prisoners than before, of course, and the prison camps were full. So we were going to an army transit camp until extensions had been built on the Luftwaffe camps. So I won't go into that, but it was a very horrendous journey in cattle trucks for about 3 days. Now, we had a bale of straw put in these cattle trucks, and somehow or other I got lodged on top of this in a sort of cooped up position, rather like a chicken on a bale of hay. And I've got to say this for my Air Force colleagues, nobody griped and said, no, let's spread that straw over here, they left me to it. But for all that was a horrendous job. You imagine trying to climb up into a railway wagon when you're fit and get down like to go to the loo and that kind of thing. Anyway, all things come to an end, so arrived in the prison camp. Now, they sent down to the station some Russians with an ox cart to pick up the wounded, and so I came in with them. So when we got into the camp, eventually, the main body, which would be about 80, I suppose, people, had dispersed. So it was a beautiful September evening, warm, lovely it was. We had to take all our clothes off, and when we arrived, there was these gas ovens. You could smell they were gas ovens, but you know, I realised what they were. I wasn't worried. And we took our clothes off. They were hung in hangers in these, and there was delousing, you see. But there was a form there, wooden form, and there was also a sheep shearing machine. So of course, being the brainy bugger that I am, I said to them, I said, we work on the farm right here. Well, what do you mean? Where's the sheep shearing machine? You know. Anyway, round the corner comes a ruddy German and sits, one points to the other one, turns the handle three times over your head, and the hair was all gone. So I didn't object really. So we had the jabs and a shower. And that was it. So that was my introduction to Stalag 4B. Well, then, I just got used to the place, I suppose, a routine. And after roll call one night, the various names were read out to report to the German Kommandantur. That's like the guard room. So I was one of them. So perpetual optimist, I thought, my God, perhaps I've got a food parcel come through. Bit quick, but you know. So we stood there outside the guard room, milling around, as usual, with the Germans. Nobody knew what we were there for, really, at all.
Where is this camp?
Stalag 4B.
Whereabouts?
Nuremberg. Between Dresden and Leipzig, on the River Elbe. Well, about 2 miles from the River Elbe. The nearest town is a place called Riesa. A steel-making town, not far from Meissen. So it was an army camp. So, the others had been absorbed before us into the camp. So anyway, we after a while hanging about, we were told to go back to the barracks. So we went back and, what was going on? But on the way back down the road, one of the chaps suddenly said, do you realise that we were all shot down at Munich? My God, you know, what's afoot? Anyway, nothing happens. That was that. Anyway, about 4 days later, the same names were read out. Appear with all your belongings, you see, at the guard room. Wow, we didn't have any bloody belongings, did we? So I had a pair of sabots, by the way, wooden sabots to walk with. I can get a pair of boots at that time. So we go down there, and we were lodged then in another barracks in the French end of the camp. I suppose he must have had a bunk, I don't know. Incidentally, the bunks had wooden boards laid on where there were three high and three next to it, and they were placed so there was about 18 down an alleyway. We had a palliasse, which was, I don't know how to describe it really, it's like a paper sack, I suppose, and it was woven. And that was stuffed with what we would call these days shredded paper. And I had two blankets. They were Alla Italia, that's Italian Airlines, absolutely threadbare and worn round the edges. And I suppose they'd been issued to hundreds of people before. I had a billy can given to me, and a spoon, and the billy can had so many carvings on it, people with rations and all that. I imagine half the Russian army had had them, but that's all we got. It were made like beggars. So, where did I get to?
You were talking about.
So they said, pray with your belongings, you see, that's all we had. So we got and to this place, and they put us in a barracks for the night. And the next day, a contingent of Luftwaffe, German Air Force soldiers came. There was a captain, a sergeant, and perhaps about 10. They marched us to the station, and they wouldn't tell us where we were going. The captain, he was very good. He used to march in front of us and clear the way, and the sergeant spoke perfect English. And of course, you know how it is. We had so many to a carriage, and it wasn't long before, yeah, we were all mates together, you know. And the Germans are very keen to show you pictures of their family. And the thing that struck me, that the women, I don't know where these Nordic blondes are, but you never saw one. They all look distinctly Jewish, very dark. And they got quite friendly. And so they took us back. And we were lodged in this German aerodrome. Of course, we were very concerned about all this. Now, this German, these new barracks are very commonly known now, but beautiful barracks, really. There's a central corridor. They're about four floors high with cellars. There's a central corridor, and rooms are the side for perhaps 12 men. And all the way down the corridor, there was racks for rifles. We had two rooms at the end of the corridor near the entrance door, and the German guards were lodged in the end room opposite. So the toilet was in the middle of the block, so you had to ask permission to go down there. And in theory, there should have been a guard sat outside, sat on these rifle racks, guarding the door. Well, one particular day I wanted to go to the loo, and I opened the door, and the interpreter we had, another Austrian, a man whose name was Richard Dasberger, I found out since, very good, very nice, was talking to the German guards in their room, and I kept hearing him say something about the opera house, Opernhaus. So I turned back to my friends and I said, I don't know, I want to put the window up here. I said, but something's going to happen in the Reddy Opera House. So we were waiting a few days for about six men to come from another prison camp. They somehow or other got into a Luftwaffe camp. And of course, we were having a good time. We went in the German mess, the sergeant's mess, where we were fed. Same food as them. It was like pea soup stuff that they have. But for what we'd been having, it was great. Of course, some of us showed our gratitude by pinching the really nice forks. I didn't, but anyway. So, then this particular day came, and we were ordered out. So, we were taken out to a corner of the aerodrome where there was a gate, and lined up, there was this big fence around. And, well, there were 28 of us, I think, and there must have been at least 50 German soldiers around with these spies or submachine guns. And an officer came out, and he read a thing out from in English. And the words he used were, I thought I got them near about right, but the content of it, he said, started off, terror bombers, murderers of the air. After the devastating raids on the beautiful open city of Munich, Reich Marshal Göring has declared that you should be brought back and shown the damage that you have caused. There was a bit more going on. He said you will be shown, and there was a mention of a brewery, a maternity hospital, a football ground, other items of, sort of civilian sort of type of targets. And then he said, unlike Mr. Churchill, the Führer does not often quote the Bible, but one expression that he has been known to say is, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And when the time comes, as come it will, you'll be made to pay for your crimes in full. Well, after that, we went out the gate, and there was a bus with a trailer. You know, like you get in these foreign places, a passenger trailer. So I took the precaution of getting in the bus. And we got in, and we were between, for every one of us, either side, there was an officer. Mostly young German army officers. And I suppose they scoured the area for those who could speak English. And, oh, very friendly. So off we go. And a bit of gentle conversation. Well, you know, Munich's an open city. What are you bombing? So I pointed to some chimneys, like the idiot that I always am, and said, well, what are those? He said, well, that's a power station. Anyway, I didn't say, well, that's a legitimate target. And I said, well, when we pass the famous beer cellar in Munich, will you point it out to us? Oh, he said, that's in the centre of the town, which isn't damaged. We're not going anywhere near there. But, of course, it became a bit of a laugh then. We joined, swapping the fags and all that. And I heard one chap say the other side of me, oh, well, only the bomb aimer knows what we're bombing. He was a bloody bomb aimer behind him. So, anyway, they showed us these things, a brewery and a football ground. And we come out then into the edge of a square, and you could see at the end of the square the opera house. No mistake in that. Not a soul in the square, but across each road, a couple of dozen policemen shoulder to shoulder. I thought, this is it. So we pulled up outside the building. We got out, and I thought, well, there, this is the thing now. But we went in. The several doors in the front, a big bronze thing. But anyway, the end ones was open. He went in through there. And inside was just the same as we had, like somewhere, I imagine, where you leave hat and coat. And I can remember a glass cubicle. Well, I don't think it was a paid desk, but probably a doorman sat in there or something. And steps alongside. So we went up these steps, and there was a landing. And we went up some more steps to the circle. But on this landing, there are three columns with a bust on the top. And the first one was Shakespeare. And that cheered me no end. And also, by that time, I began to realise that there wasn't a sound from this building. I thought, there can't be anybody in here. There was no warmth or anything. So we come through a door into the circle. And, of course, it was empty with a bomb hole in the roof. It had only been a smallish bomb anyway, and a bit of stuff churned up. So we stood there, and in came, well, perhaps five or six very high-ranking Air Force officers. They're red epaulets and staff, they were, you know, on the trousers there. Very friendly, spoke perfect English. And I got in with the group. There were about five of us, and one of them was Ray Edgehill, whom you met. Well, when his hair was shaved off, he'd grown a beard in protest and a big black beard. And another one was Bill Gurton. He was the same. Now, Bill Gurton had a florid face and a big nose. Reminded you of Punch. Of course, he'd grown a beard, you see. So this officer looked at us and he said, well, why have some of you got your hair cut off like the Russians? So I said, well, I did that in the camp. And he said, did you object? But I didn't object. Because I knew what it was for. It was anti-typhus and for health reasons. Anyway, Ray Edgehill said, yeah, we do most strongly. That's why we brought these beards. So this chap said, right, I'll have it stopped. And I give him his due. After about a fortnight, they stopped cutting the hair off in Newburgh. Now, of course, I don't think they cut the hair off in the Luftwaffe camps anyway. This was a standard thing because, I mean, there were 23 different nationalities in Stalag 4B, you see. And, of course, these Russians, they treated them like animals. So it was standard. Everybody had their hair cut off. So that was it. We went back in the coach, and, of course, that was the end of it. We hadn't been paraded on the stage or anything. So, of course, the question came up, what was it all about? So, and a couple of days later, we went back to Stalag 4B. And it was night time when we approached, and I remember this captain saying, would we sing to show them that we weren't unhappy? And I was sorry, we couldn't think of anything to sing. You can't sing and roll out the bower and all that. Of course, these Germans got beautiful marching songs. They sing and some in the oodles and everything, you know. We couldn't. So that was that. Well, of course, when I think about it now, it was all done. We raided Peenemunde, where they were testing these rockets. Our espionage was telling us about these ski sites, they call them in France. We were bombing the factory where they built them, and they wanted to know what we knew about it. I suspect they were trying to pump us, you see. But they couldn't have got anything out of us. So, of course, we didn't know for a start. But that's what I think it was all about. So, that was that, really.
How soon after the day of the bombing did you go back to Munich?
Well, it was about the middle of October. It was about the 15th. There's some argument about this, because some of the chaps were given Red Cross books like this, and like diaries. I didn't get one. And Jack, our engineer, he'd written in his, but we think now that he'd got a week adrift in his writing for the date.
Did you feel any remorse about the bombing after you'd seen Munich?
Well, no, they only showed us selected bits. It's obvious, I mean, we were always given a target. So at least, I was on a Canadian squadron, they always told us what we were doing, and we were bombing the BMW works. Now, I do have remorse, of course. Men and adults fight the wars, they know what they're doing. I'm sorry for the children that got killed and maimed. And incidentally, I think we lost more men on the radar in Munich than they did. I've got in the papers how many policemen, soldiers, prisoners of war, women were killed and injured, and children. There's always a few children. Of course I object to that. But what does wire me up a bit, everyone goes on about Dresden. And if you see these things on TV, they don't talk to anybody who knows. They get a bloody housewife from Dresden sounding off about it. Well, do you ever hear a housewife from Hamburg? No. And they suffered more than Dresden, I think. I mean, they went there four times, and the Americans went in between when we went there. They had a firestorm there. They never been anything like it. It just took away and burnt. People were being mummified. They had to get in the canals and the water to only way they could survive. That must have been terrible. And that wasn't planned.
What did the bombing of Hamburg look like to you on those raids in July?
Well, you couldn't tell. Obviously, you saw masses of fire, yes. But there was lots of smoke coming up, like you get from an oil refinery, that kind of thing. You know, I would think most my colleagues anyway had the same view as me. They're sorry for the suffering that passed. But then again, you think of the Germans, they actually set out and dive-bombed Rotterdam. You know, we've never done anything like that. And it's inevitable that suppose the attack on us had been like the first one, only damaged us, and we still had our bomb load aboard. For our own survival, we would have had to jettison the bombs wherever. Well, if they blasted the hell out of a farmhouse out in the country, you'd say, what, you're bombing there? But I mean, that's the way it goes on, isn't it? You don't know. And this is the same as the Opera House. I had thought at one time when I heard about the Opera House that I knew that Hermann Göring's wife was an opera.